Blades of Glory. After the triumphal procession, there follows an allegory, further pandering to the royal ego. It is a representation of how Europe, in French eyes, is currently arranged. In a position of unquestioned dominance stands the Seine, the main artery of Paris, and here the symbol of France. The river expects and receives cowering homage from six major waterways: the Thames, the Meuse, the Neckar, the Scheldt, the Rhine, and the Danube. For Louis, this was an evening that he had looked back on as a watershed in his reign. Before it stood years of victorious wars and mounting dynastic solidity. After it came repeated hammer blows of disappointment, both military and familial. Our eyewitness Saint-Simon marked the moment everything changed. Even while these rejoicings were being celebrated, news reached us which spread consternation in every family and cast a gloom over the whole city. The first reports of Blenheim were reaching Paris. Louis XIV bestrode the end of the 17th and the opening of the 18th centuries with a mixture of menace and panache. A dominating figure, the Sun King relied on military might to impose his pungent brand of autocracy through 7 decades of European history. France had 20 million inhabitants, 3 times the population of Spain, 4 times that of England, and 9 times that of the Netherlands. Louis harnessed this numerical advantage, building a huge, efficient army, and in a ferocious quest for personal glory and national security, unleashed it on France's neighbours. Louis's outlook was underpinned by 2 prejudices, a passionate belief in the divine right of kings, and a violent abhorrence of Protestantism. His life's aim was to create a force in the centre of Europe which he could lead with distinction. In September 1651, the 13-year-old boy king gamely announced to Parlement that he was assuming his place as active head of state. However, this was premature, for the real power still resided with Cardinal Mazarin, Louis's first minister. This Machiavellian cleric remained the de facto ruler of France until his death in 1661. Only then did Louis wrest the power that his self-esteem so craved. Confident in his regal status, the king informed his politicians, "You will assist me with your advice when I ask for it." This was to be less often than they could possibly have envisaged. It was the start of an autocratic reign that led Winston S. Churchill to accord Louis a unique place in historical infamy. No worse enemy of human freedom has ever appeared in the trappings of polite civilization. Insatiable appetite, cold, calculating ruthlessness, monumental conceit, presented themselves armed with fire and sword. The year he assumed real power, the 23-year-old king married Maria Theresa, a daughter of King Philip IV of Spain. The potential of this union between Bourbon and Habsburg, the 2 most powerful dynasties of Western Europe, was enormous, but he could not capitalise on the match straight away. As he explained in his memoirs, Louis's domestic problems came first, for in his kingdom, disorder reigned everywhere. Indeed, at the time of the wedding, international pressure persuaded Louis to renounce any future rights to the Spanish throne, on condition that France receive the compensation of a sizeable dowry. This was not paid. To the rest of Europe, this was an unfortunate reflection of Spain's powerless finances, which had brought bread riots to her cities. However, to Louis, the non-payment constituted a clear breach of contract. It kept alive his hopes that, in the right circumstances, he could lop off various branches of the huge Spanish Empire for French consumption. His opportunity came in 1665, when Philip IV of Spain died, leaving the throne to 4-year-old Carlos II, a sickly boy not expected to see adulthood. Better yet, Carlos had no obvious heir. Louis decided that the Spanish Netherlands, roughly equating to modern-day Belgium, would be fitting compensation for the unpaid dowry. The region had been the springboard for Spanish invasions during the 15th and 16th centuries, so its annexation would solve a long-standing strategic problem for France. Louis informed his mother-in-law, the Queen Regent of Spain, of his intentions, and negotiations began. They ended in 1667, when Louis ordered his army to attack. Marshal Turenne, perhaps Louis's most able commander, led 50,000 French troops on campaign accompanied by his king. Thirsting to be in at the kill, Louis travelled in characteristic style, accompanied by his queen and two of his mistresses. Turenne captured half a dozen towns before laying siege to the city of Lille. Vauban, the king's renowned siege expert, cracked the Spanish defences within a month. Louis had expected support from the Dutch United Provinces, whose savage and protracted war of liberation from Spanish control had made them natural opponents of the Habsburgs. Only 5 years previously, they had signed a treaty with France, guaranteeing mutual armed assistance for the next 25 years. However, the Dutch had since recognised that Spanish power was fading at the same moment that they appreciated the scope of Louis's ambitions. Now, instead of joining Louis in the invasion, the Dutch reneged on the treaty. The United Provinces sought help from two fellow Protestant countries, England and Sweden. The union with the English was surprising, since the two countries had recently been at war. Dutch warships had stormed up the Thames to burn a British fleet. Nevertheless, this new confederacy, the Triple Alliance, informed Louis that it would take up arms against him unless he withdrew from the Spanish Netherlands. Louis was outraged by this betrayal, but had to cease hostilities. France emerged from the Peace of Aix-la-Chapelle in possession of a handful of towns and cities, including Tournai, Oudenarde and Lille. However, convinced that the perfidy of the Dutch had denied him the lordship of the whole of the Spanish Netherlands, Louis plotted his vengeance. First, he exploited his ties with Charles II of England. The two kings were first cousins, and Charles, albeit secretly, shared Louis's Catholic faith. Charles's sister, Henrietta, was married to Louis's brother, the Duke of Orléans, and she acted as the conduit between the two courts in secret negotiations that led to the Treaty of Dover in May 1670. England and France agreed, their joint resolution to humble the pride of the States General, the Dutch Parliament, and to destroy the power of a people which has shown ingratitude to those who have helped to create its republic. The alliance was cemented by massive bribery. Louis paid Charles a secret pension of £225,000 a year for the duration of the war. He also insisted on a clause that committed Charles to re-establishing Catholicism in Britain. Charles II took the money, but shrank from challenging the staunch Anglicanism of his people. Sweden proved equally receptive to French gold. For years the Protestant champion of Europe, the Swedes were beginning to place territorial ambition over religious solidarity. Already in control of Finland, Estonia, Livonia and West Pomerania, Swedish ambitions now extended to Denmark and Poland. The Dutch could fend for themselves. Having torn the wings off the Triple Alliance, Louis entrusted his most seasoned and dynamic marshals with the avenging invasion. In 1672, Turenne and Condé marched through the bishopric of Liège with 120,000 troops before advancing along the Rhine. Facing just 25,000 Dutch soldiers, the French swarmed over the southern areas of the United Provinces. Louis ordered a war of dark aggression. "Go, my children," Marshal Luxembourg exhorted his men. "Plunder, murder, destroy. And if it be possible to commit yet greater cruelties, be not negligent therein. Let me see that I am not deceived in my choice of the flower of the king's troops." The Dutch took desperate measures. In coastal Holland, the dike's sluice gates were opened, flooding the low-lying land to form the defensive waterline. This held the French back through the autumn, but in late December, winter frosts turned the expanses of water into ice. Marshal Luxembourg issued skates to his foot soldiers so they could speed across the frozen flats. French soldiers raped the women of Bodegraven and Zwammerdam before razing both towns to the ground and burning alive many of their inhabitants. Louis's policy of deliberate terror won him Leiden, whose citizens greeted the invaders in cowed surrender, but the atrocities were ultimately counterproductive, inspiring lasting hatred of France. The De Witt brothers, key Dutch allies of Louis's before the war, were seized by the mob and their ripped-out hearts placed on public display. In the De Witt's place emerged William of Orange, the leading member of the family that had ruled the Dutch before the advent of the Republic. By blood a prince, William was now created stadtholder, the generalissimo of the Republic's forces. In their desperation, the States General were prepared to proclaim this living vestige of their nation's royal past, captain and admiral general for life. This, despite William's being, in Voltaire's estimation, merely a young prince in poor health, who had seen neither siege nor combat.